Hello, hello again. It's Shelby with Hoax, Books, and Crime, and it's Craft and Story time. I crochet and tell you a horrible story. If you like true crime and if you like to craft, please like and follow this channel. Let me be your girl. All right, let's get to it though. This is the week of Friday the 13th, and I have a Friday the 13th story for you. And I'm someone from Texas. I was really surprised I hadn't heard of this before. But let's get started. So the year is 1990, the year I was born, and we are in a city called, well, I wouldn't even say a city, it's a small town, called Panhandle, Texas. And if you couldn't guess, it's on the Texas Panhandle. Shocker! So this town, you know, of course, it rides the Bible Belt, so it's very conservative, especially in the 90s. We are in the age of the Satanic Panic. So this area, and I can relate a lot to this area because it seems like these kids grew up on like farm roads, and that's how I grew up. I live in the city now, but I was raised as a little country bumpkin, and I grew up on a farm road. Like I didn't live on a street that had like a block and a street name. It was numbers, farm to market road, more numbers, and that's how this town is. And the thing with small towns is crime is usually pretty minimal, especially violent crime. Less number of people, less problems normally. So everybody in Panhandle, Texas, for the most part, thinks they're in a pretty safe area. Their children are safe. They're safe. And all of that is just gone in a flash on July 13th of 1990. That night, a man is returning from a bar, his name being Jimmy Britton. He had been out with some friends, and you know, he's ready to turn in for the night. There's a knock on the door, which I'm sure he's a little perplexed about because of the time it is, but he goes to check. And standing outside is a teenager. They're asking to use his phone. He's a little confused. But, you know, he decides to be a good neighbor and allows him inside. And pretty immediately, this kid snaps. And he just attacks Jimmy. He pulls a knife and starts slashing at him. He is slicing at Jimmy again and again, making contact with him. And Jimmy is putting up a good fight, though. But again, he was kind of in a drunken stupor just before. Not necessarily a drunken stupor, but, you know, he had had some drinks, so he wasn't as aware and vigilant as he normally would be. And they're fighting, and this struggle is just, you know, you don't know who's going to win this one. He's in a full-fledged fight for his life. But suddenly, the kid pulls away. And he starts vomiting all over Jimmy's floor. After he throws up, he runs outside and basically, like, continues to vomit. And this gives Jimmy some time to think for a minute. While this kid runs outside, Jimmy, badly wounded at this point, he slams his door, he shuts it and locks it. And he starts to make his way to the phone. As Jimmy's dialing 911, he looks out the window to see where this kid is, hoping he left. However, this kid is watching him through the window, but he's pacing back and forth, like almost as if he's trying to hype himself up to try to get to Jimmy again. But Jimmy stays on the phone with 911, and once he hangs up, he looks outside again, and the kid's gone. So when responders arrive on the scene, of course, they're looking at Jimmy, and he has lost quite a bit of blood. However, he is expected to survive, and he is able to speak to investigators to give them an idea of what happened here. Again, violent crime is just not common in Panhandle. Especially something as peculiar as this. And when they talk to him, he tells them immediately, like, I know exactly who attacked me. And he names a teenager named Kenneth Glenn Milner, known around town as Glenn. Glenn had had some trouble already. He was well known around town for some issues he had caused, some of the disturbances. One of them being climbing the water tower and threatening to jump off, which, does hint at mental instability. But in 1988, he also drove off of a cliff. He survived, really, without any life-changing injuries, which is pretty remarkable. However, this didn't stop him from continuously making suicidal threats. And eventually he's committed to a psychiatric hospital. And Glenn definitely wasn't a dummy. He seemed to pick up pretty quickly as onto what the doctor wanted to hear, what they wanted to see for results. So he played off of this and convinced the doctors that he was fine. He's cured. He's ready to be released back into the wild. And 2 years later, we have this attack. So police are like, okay, so this wasn't a random attack. Clearly, Jimmy forbidding his stepdaughter from being with Glenn is the motivation here. But now they have to ask, is he only going after Jimmy? Or is he on some type of revenge trip? Police go to Glenn's house. Glenn lived with his parents, and they allowed the police to come in and search his room. They had not seen Glenn that night. They knew he was out. Of course, they weren't aware what he was up to. So they allowed police to go and search his room. And what they find really, I'm sure, scares the living hell out of them, or just really, put them on their toes. So Glenn, let's just start off with this. Glenn is actually really into horror films. And there's like, I love horror films. There's a lot of us who love horror films. I highly doubt that we love horror films the way that Glenn loves horror films. So Glenn painted his bedroom black, which, okay, not too crazy, right? Had a bunch of horror movie posters, around his bed, which I'm pretty sure those posters were so awesome because you have like 80s slasher and giallo and all that stuff going on back then. Horror so bad, much better back then than now. But the posters aren't exactly like a concern either, right? But then this kid has a shit ton of masks that he's made laying around his room. Very grotesque masks, to show like injuries and to look like horror movies and everything. And they're just all strewn around his room. And then police see something like in the corner of his bedroom. And they think that they're looking at a corpse. Upon closer inspection, it's actually a dummy that Glenn made. And he would use this dummy kind of as a prop for, like, I don't know. I'm guessing like pretending to murder and copying horror movies. Like, it's just, what a creepy thing to find. A dummy in someone's room who just tried to murder someone. I feel like that's almost scarier than a damn mannequin. And I don't like the idea of mannequins. Mannequins weird me out. The dummy scares me more. Aside from all of Glenn's weird shit, the alarm bells really go off when they find a handwritten kill list. And Jimmy Britton's name is listed on there, as well as a bunch of other people around town, as well as fellow students from school. So police know they need to move and they need to find him immediately. Because more than likely, this is all going to keep going down. He's not going to take a break. He's going to be on a rampage. While looking for Glenn, officers actually stop at Glenn's best friend's house, Craig Shackelford. You know, like Rusty Shackelford from King of the Hill. I'm just kidding. But they go to Craig's house to get some insight on Glenn. Maybe Glenn disclosed some of his plans to him. Or maybe even Glenn's behavior has changed recently. So they go to question Craig and see what they can and learn what they can about Glenn. Craig is more than willing to speak to the police. He tells them that Glenn actually was acting different soon before this. He seemed a little bit unhinged. Apparently, his voice would change at times. Then, Craig presents officers with a note. Inside this note were instructions. Directions to a box that Glenn had hidden right outside of town. So officers go ahead and follow the directions, and what they find is a green ammunition box buried in the dirt. Inside were three handwritten letters, as well as a tape. These three letters are addressed to three different people. One to Craig Shackelford, one to Glenn's parents, and the other, along with the tape, go to Glenn's ex-girlfriend, Kenya, who's an employee at a local news station. So when officers read her letter, they realize pretty quickly that Glenn is planning on dying after this whole thing. More than likely, a suicide by cop kind of situation. But he also tells her, you know, that he's giving her a career-making scoop, almost like he's doing this for her as a favor. The tape is addressed to his parents. On it, Glenn spoke calmly, and he makes it very clear that what he's doing and why he's doing this has nothing to do with them, and that they didn't do anything wrong, that they were basically great parents, that they shouldn't blame themselves for this. He tells them that this has always been in his head. These dark thoughts and fascinations that he's always been idolizing serial killers, and that he was tired of living. He wanted all of it to end. After reading these letters, I think it becomes even clearer that Glenn's not going to just stop. They really need to find him. So using the kill list that they found in his room, police began to do welfare checks door to door to everybody on that list. There was quite a bit of names on Glenn's list that actually were all out together at a keg party that night. And when police questioned them, they actually say that Glenn kind of just showed up unexpectedly. And he wasn't really interacting. He was just observing everybody, watching them. But he was witnessed taking some sort of pills and drinking. And the thing with Glenn is, he was actually friends with a lot of these kids. Glenn wasn't this weirdo recluse that, you know, he stayed away from everybody and everybody stayed away from him. It wasn't that kind of situation. Glenn was actually quite popular. He was well liked by his peers. Kids knew that he was into horror and they knew he liked making these grotesque masks. But even though it was a little odd, they saw that it was just him using his talents. They knew he was very talented with that. He was also smart. He did well in school. So he may have had, like, you know, little disagreements and tiffs, but he definitely was not friendless. They liked him, and he seemed to be rather social. So him being at the keg party didn't throw anybody off. It didn't make them nervous. Nothing like that. Rather, it was him just observing and being quiet that, you know, maybe confused them a little, maybe put them off a little. But it definitely wasn't this giant red flag that made them feel that they needed to get away from him. However, he began to throw up. He starts throwing up at the party. Again, embarrassing. And he leaves. Nobody at the keg party was harmed. So police can check off these names as, you know, well and accounted for. So as they're driving door to door, another call comes in. The high school principal, Kenneth Williams, has been shot by Glenn. He had showed up at the principal's house. The principal had already put his kids to bed. He was asleep next to his wife. And then a knock came in at the door. A little annoyed that somebody would even be knocking this late at night, he goes to check and he sees Glenn Milner through the peephole. And he knows rather immediately, something's wrong, something's off. He's not going to open the door for Glenn. And Glenn is trying to convince him to open the door and let him in. And Kenneth is basically telling him, no, I'm not going to let you in. He tells him to go home. And suddenly, a gunshot. Glenn has shot Kenneth Williams through the door, and he's hit. This causes his wife to come out of bed and rush to see what happened. Another shot follows, blowing his leg out from under him. Kenneth Williams' wife, panicked but trying her best to keep her composure, sticks her finger in her husband's gunshot to prevent any bleed out, and they call 911. Police are in pursuit. They're en route to their house, but Glenn's gone again. By the time they get there, Glenn is nowhere to be found. After speaking to Kenneth Williams and transporting him to the hospital, officers are back on the street looking for Glenn Milner. And at around 3 a.m., they see Glenn's car parked outside of a business. And when they approach the vehicle, they actually see that Glenn is just sitting inside the vehicle. He also has a gun laying next to him. And remember, he planned to kill himself or die by being shot by law enforcement. So when they tell him to put his hands up and surrender, they're expecting him to shoot himself. But to their surprise, he surrenders and exits the vehicle. When Glenn surrenders and exits the vehicle, officers notice the dead look in his eyes. He's completely emotionless and just cold to the fact of everything he's just done. When they interview Glenn later, he'll say that the reason why he surrendered himself is because he forgot the incantation that he was supposed to say before killing himself. Because along with his fascination with serial killers and, you know, the macabre and everything, he also was a Satan worshiper. He was part of the satanic panic. So as police speak to Glenn, You know, he's in their custody. They're getting all the answers that they wanted. And they're actually confident and proud of the fact that they were able to catch him before anybody died. Unfortunately, they're wrong. Jimmy Britton was not his first victim that day. So as the sun is coming up that morning, another call comes in. A boy named Frankie Garcia has been found in an abandoned barn that is quite a popular place for teens around that area. They call it the haunted house. Kids go there to drink, probably to make out. Some go there to get scared. But it is a well-known structure. When police enter the barn, also known as the haunted house, one thing they notice rather quickly is a pentagram etched into the dirt. And there's blood pooled at the center. And then they see towards the back a boy laying face down in a pool of blood. This boy is on the kill list, and his name is Frankie Garcia. So when they find all this out, they go back to Glenn and question him about all of this. How did this happen? When did this happen? They need answers. Glenn confesses to this murder, and he tells officers that he prepared the barn in advance. Then he went to the school and asked Frankie if he wanted to go have some drinks with him. He wanted to drive around and drink. Frankie apparently was a little skeptical. He even told Glenn's friend Craig, like, I didn't even think he liked me. But he was willing to put his thoughts, those thoughts aside, and he went ahead and joined Glenn Milner. Glenn takes him to the haunted house, which I'm sure this kid was already kind of on edge and nervous, and suddenly pulls a gun on Frankie. Frankie's terrified. He's frozen. And he's forced to kneel. Glenn then puts the barrel of the gun in Frankie's mouth and pulls the trigger. And the whole reason that Frankie was even on this kill list is not because Frankie ever wronged him, not because he felt Frankie was a bad person. Frankie was on this list because Glenn felt that he needed to kill the virgin. Which is just such a gross reason to end a life. Kenneth Glenn Milner wanted the death penalty. That's what he requested. Texas said, no, you don't get to have what you want. He is actually sentenced to 3 consecutive life sentences instead. While he was in court, he actually said to his victims, his surviving victims, that if he were to ever get out, he'd finish the job. As for Frankie Garcia is remembered as an innocent kid killed by someone he thought he could trust and that he was going to befriend. This murder intensified the satanic panic that was already taking place, especially in conservative towns like Panhandle, Texas. Glenn idolized Jack the Ripper and Charles Manson. He was obsessed with death with horror. He read the Necronomicon and the Bible. He drank. He self-harmed. He struggled with anger and depression. And seemed like he was a little lost. And one night he decided to stop hiding and let the dark thoughts take over. A small town learned that monsters don't always look like outsiders. Sometimes they're well-dressed, sometimes they're talented, sometimes they're friendly, and sometimes they're already on the inside. And that is the story of Kenneth Glenn Milner. Again, I'm Shelby with Hooks, Books, and Crime. And remember, evil looks just like us. Okay, bye.